This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 22nd of January, 1961. The title of this lecture is Evolution of Early Research, Pre-Halve Scale. This lecture is 41 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Now, we have a little interesting item here, which is quite amazing. I see I'm still being pursued by a tomato. If you look in this week's Farmers Weekly, which is on the newsstands, there's no charge for this commercial. If you look in this week's Farmers Weekly, which is, I think, now on the newsstand, why, you will see me gazing at a tomato. Very interesting how this story gripped the imagination of people. I wonder what they thought life was. This whole experiment was simply and totally conducted to find out if life is the same order of magnitude no matter what sort of a body gets grown. I was trying to establish that one fact, and I got into the field of horticulture, where I don't necessarily not belong, and got myself all mixed up in various things, and I notice now I'm good enough to have most of my experiments done incorrectly by the University of Texas. But here's the story that goes with it. Plants can worry and feel pain. Well, that's an extension of our good friend the E-meter. Now, you know, it's a good thing that this isn't a 3 or 4 day Congress, because you'd learn all about Scientology then, and you would have considerable difficulties in life. All your friends would hate you, but maybe you'd understand them. And maybe your IQ would go up and you'd start earning a living and living a happy married life and being nice to your children. All sorts of catastrophic things would be likely to occur. Congress used to be about 4 days long. They gradually shortened. They shortened to 3 days, and then they shortened to 2 days. And then they'll shortly shorten to no days. The reason for that is that trying to keep the show on the road. Somebody, staff member, said to me one time, anybody who's very religious, don't listen to this remark. Staff member said to me one time in London, said, God himself couldn't hold down your job. And I said, that's right. There's no irreverence involved. I was talking about a small god down in one of the Juju tribes. Frankly, the amount of traffic which is going on at this time throughout the world in Scientology is tremendous. And we have actually the reconstruction and expansion of all central organizations under the gun. We have all sorts of training, and we are terribly short of personnel. There are very, very few of us. It becomes startlingly apparent the moment you begin to expand. And therefore, everybody has to do 10 people's work. So what I'm doing in research, I'm working out a process of mitosis. A mitosis is a process whereby one cell, you see, becomes two cells, and the second cell knows everything that the first cell knows, and they're identical, you see. And I think this process, if applied to Scientologists and done rapidly enough, might give us enough Scientologists fast enough, but nothing short of that would. We have made a bid to inherit most of the psychotherapy on Earth, since there wasn't any. I beg your pardon, I mean that. They were keeping alive the tradition. And I can be quoted for that. I thank them for keeping alive the tradition. Actually, Freudian analysis works, but nobody ever practices it. I learned how to do Freudian analysis when I was a kid. It isn't too complicated. And was actually doing some things with it, and I ran into Freudian analysts afterwards, and they didn't know anything much about it, but they sure were practicing. I hope we never get like that in Scientology. But new data, of course, is always the first line. Technology is my first and foremost importance, and that is the one thing which I follow relentlessly and carry through. Technology is expanding something on this basis. I could process somebody and get a result. I could process lots of people and get results. I could process nearly everybody I laid my hands on and get results. I could process everybody I laid my hands on and get results. Get the expansion? Had nothing to do with an auditor. Now we start back the same cycle over here. An auditor could process some people and get results with what we knew. Now he got a little bit better, and I learned to communicate a bit better to him, and he could get results on more people. Right now, I think he's probably up to about 80%. This is pretty terrific. A well-trained auditor can get results easily on about 80% of the cases he confronts. The remaining 20%, of course, would be the fantastically unable people, the psychotic, the extreme neurotic, the people who will not sit still to be audited, institutional cases, cases that are totally bedridden and deaf and dumb, you know, cases of this character. He can get results straight up the line there. We're running an ACC immediately after this Congress, and it's basically dedicated to getting old-time auditors up to a point where they can get this broader percentage. Any practitioner can get 22.5%. Any practitioner, anybody, he gets at least 22.5%. If he fed people nothing but flour and water pills, he would get 22.5% cures. 22.5% of every 100 people who came to him would get well. That is inevitable. If he did nothing, if he waved his magic wand, if he suba-subed, I don't know, there's something around they copied out of Dianetics. If you stand still enough, you can get an engram to go bang. And they're having a good time doing this. Who's going to bail them out, I don't know. But that's all that consists of. By the way, it isn't even technically correct, the old-time lineups of it. But they should get 22.5% results. Any witch doctor, any juju, any psychiatrist, they should get. The only ones who aren't getting their 22.5% today are the psychoanalysts and the psychiatrists. They don't get 22.5%. I said to him one day, I explained this to one, and I said, why aren't you getting your 22.5%? You must be working hard not to. He just inevitably would if he just sat comfortably back at his mahogany desk, 22.5 people out of every 100, that half person I don't know about. But 22.5 people out of every 100 that walked into his office would get well. So don't feel so proud if 1 out of 5 of your PCs is improving. If only 1 out of 6 of your PCs is improving, you must be working the wrong way too. If only 1 out of 10 is improving, boy, wow, gosh, you know, you must have to pick up vases of flowers and throw them at them in the middle of session and scream at them and sick the dog on them. Call up the PC's wife and say he's just been seen in a bar with a blonde. You'd have to work at it, so you'd only get 1 out of 10. That 22.5% is always there. Anybody can hang up a signal saying anything and get 22.5%. That's a good thing to know. Because it's only when you expand 22.5% up toward 30%, you know you are doing something. Now if we expand it to 35%, aha, now we're really doing something. Now if we expand it to 50%, we have already gone over the top of every healing profession there is. We did that years ago. We were at 50% in Dianetics and Scientology, years ago. And now, with a well-trained practitioner, we're at 80. And that is really Olympian heights. Now, when you consider that, well, one out of every 15 people is stark-staring institutionally mad in the United States today, according to the latest psychiatric figures. I have a good joke on that. There's a chap by the name of Menninger. You probably never heard of him. But he hangs out in Wichita or Kansas City or some jerkwater joint. And when they've spent all their money with him, he ships them across the river to the state institution. And Menninger wrote a book once called The Human Mind, and he's done a lot of things. But he came out, and they asked him what the percentage was. It was 1 out of 15 correct. And Menninger says, no, no. At some time or another, everybody is insane. Everyone. Everyone is crazy at some time or another. It's 100%. So I cut the clipping out of the book and pinned it to a letter and said, thank you, Dr. Menninger, for confessing publicly. Now, I shouldn't be throwing brickbats at the poor fellows. It's like we had a naval battle one time and some commander made himself terribly famous by saying, don't cheer, boy, the poor devils are dying. It was a very pathetic statement to make, and I'm afraid it's just in that category. Because today we're going over the top with such a crash and thud and bang. We're making such vast inroads in the field of psychotherapy, even at a low group level, that we practically got the field monopolized and wrapped up. This is a very interesting thing because it's just happened. We found how to get procurement. We've got very good word of mouth. And by not trying to cram everybody's ears full of the most technical phrases we can think of in the first 3 minutes of explanation, why we're really getting there. Give you some idea of the simplicity of Scientology. Do you know that I've seen little six-year-old kids do very good auditing? And if you start to process a two-year-old child, very shortly this two-year-old will start to process you. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. He'll turn around and do that. Very interesting. Now, wherever we have somebody willing to audit, he can get some results in auditing. I see you're a little bit hung up on this six-year-old thing. You don't think this is possible. I didn't think it was possible either. It was a doctor's little boy. And his aunt came downstairs, and was she hungover? And, of course, she didn't want to say this nicely and politely in front of the family and so forth, but she had been awfully drunk out last night. Nobody paying attention to her. Everybody was busy not-ising it, you see. And this little boy, he says, Auntie, he said, what's wrong with you? And said, well, I don't feel well. I have a headache. And he said, all right. He said, I will audit you. When is the first time you felt bad? And he ran it as an engram. And he sat there for about an hour and a half. And he ran her through getting drunk and straight up to the end of the headache and washed it out utterly. She was so bug-eyed that she couldn't stop. She didn't quit, you know. She just sat there looking at him, you know, answering the questions. That happened quite a long time ago, but I've very often seen it happen since. And I was sitting at the Congress party in Washington, and a lot of people had come over to say hello and introduce themselves and so forth. And I was sitting down, and somebody else said, Ron, something or other, Ron. And I looked up, you know, and there was nobody up there. And I looked down, and kid about 8 years old. And he says, Ron, he says, we've got a problem. Is we've been trying to introduce Scientology into schools and into the school and so forth. But a lot of these kids, you know, he says, they're pretty goofy, you know. They just alter is everything and so on. And he starts talking the lingo, man. And he was right on the groove. The Scientology's was perfect. And I said, well, who's we? And he steps aside, and here is a seven-year-old back of him. And he says, well, I just try to audit these kids. He says, but they're badly out of control. And he says, there's nothing much you can do with them. And maybe you've got some advice for us, how to get Scientology introduced into our school. And I said, well, why don't you go find a teacher who has something physically wrong with her and offer to help her with Scientology. And she'll think that's very cute and sit still, and then you're going to surprise her to death by fixing it up. And these little kids says, by golly, that's a good idea. And they went tearing off. God help their teachers. Now they're probably all getting haunted. Well, I've always remembered a famous Chinese poet who every time he wrote a poem took it down to the corner and read it to the old lady who sold flowers. And if she didn't understand it, he tore it up. Gee, I wish college professors would do that. But I feel we're getting someplace when, little kids can pick it up and so forth. It's not for little kids, of course. By the way, they had a marvelous suggestion. Both of these kids had been well audited. Probably their old man was a professional. I didn't inquire. But they had a very good suggestion. They said, why don't you write some Scientology books for children? You know, give them all. And they said, not about children, but for children. Said that'd help us out. So I've got this whole sphere now of young Scientologists to provide for, in addition to everything else I'm doing. Feel sorry for me, will you? The whole workability of a subject is normally its simplicity, and if it isn't a simple subject, it doesn't go anyplace. Funny part of it is the more effective it gets, the more simple it gets, even though its form is sufficiently complicated to require a considerable amount of drilling and training before somebody really knows his business. But various things have happened recently. I came down here, to wrap up the South African case. This was a real sticker. The results obtained in South Africa was not as good as they were obtained in the rest of the world. I didn't come down here just to do that, but that was one of the reasons I came. We've got these cases kicked off the launching pad now, and they're rolling fine. Of course, this benefits all the cases in the world. But the South African case is not peculiar. It is simply a little bit resistant. You don't realize it, but you live in a somewhat hostile environment because there are a lot of people around that you mustn't be. And that's about all there is to it. It's you mustn't be this one, you mustn't be that one, and so forth. And the more must bees there is, why, the less beingness there is to be, don't you see? It's not very tough, but you had to have processes that would undercut this very well, very thoroughly. You had to have processes that would make it very simple to do. And the HGC auditor at the central organization now has gotten insufferable. He's completely insufferable. He's so cocky. I talked to a few of them recently and so forth. I'm very happy that they're this way, but if someone walks up to you just absolutely swaggering, and so forth around you, he's an HGC auditor over at the Central Organization. They were in the frame of mind, well, in 50 hours, if we got a small graph gain, we were doing well, see? And now they're at the frame of mind, if they don't get a big graph gain in 5 hours, they must be doing something awfully wrong. When you have this much control and command over the stability, future, intelligence of human beings, of course, it does make you cocky. Doesn't make me very cocky, but does them. In fact, they've gotten so cocky that they're now coming around individually, one after the other. They come around and demand to audit me. They don't read in the auditor's code there about a frequent change of auditors, You must... But I'm going to fool them. The next one that comes up and offers to audit me, I'm going to say, yes, sir. That'll be that. As you know, I myself have had a lot of processing. This occasionally is something that seems to be very remarkable to people, that somebody who develops something should benefit by it in any way. And matter of fact, it's apparently, well, amongst many people, a test of whether or not something's any good. I mentioned in passing the fact that I was blind, 220, 320 in my eyes, and couldn't walk except with a cane at the end of World War II. I'd had it. I'd been on 3 expeditions before that, and in 5 combat theaters, and I'd gotten remarkably second-hand by that time. There was such a scarcity of trained personnel during World War II that if you could get yourself up to the desk, they would say, certified fit for duty, you see. I've seen fellas crawling up, you know, just getting their chin over the edge. And it was very surprising to me toward the end of the war when they suddenly had enough personnel. It had gone up to several million so I could be replaced. This was crazy. I was by this time perfectly inured to it. I was perfectly willing to go overseas again. As a matter of fact, didn't want to stay stateside. Everybody was crazy. Yeah, everybody was crazy stateside because they all thought that combat veterans were crazy. They had articles in magazines and everything else telling you how to act toward your insane husband when he is demobilized. I had even been trained to go overseas again in a special category, and I reported to the medics to get the thing stamped. And they started looking through this service record, you know. Shot, exploded, malaria. What's this? See? Fell down a hatch, depth charges exploded, so on. 1 week in the hospital, 77 days in the hospital, and so forth. What's this here? I see. Flash blind, actinic conjunctivitis, so forth. Finally, the medico turned around to me and he says, look, we're not this short of men. Now, he said, we're going to send you to the Naval Hospital. And I said, well, I'm perfectly okay. I said, stand there on a cane looking at him with dark glasses. I'm perfectly okay. No, sir, he says, we're going to turn you into the hospital. He said, how have they missed all this time? Look at that. And he says, but now, he says, we have overseas physicals. We give physical examinations before we ship people into combat. And I said, how novel. And I said, but I don't want to hang around here and so forth. I said, I'd just soon go overseas. Why not? And the guy says, well, the war's almost over. And it's only a matter of time now. And we're just going to send you to the hospital. And I said, no, you're not just going to send me to the hospital. I don't want to go to the hospital. I've been in too many hospitals. And he said, well, you go in and see the dispensary's commanding officer. Well, I went in, and here was a guy who was, you know, goal-ish, you know. And I said, I haven't any desire to go to a naval hospital. I said, you might as well send me overseas. I said, the only place you ever... Well, I shouldn't go into that. And he said, we're going to send you to the hospital. As a matter of fact, he said, I'm going to call an ambulance right now and send you to the hospital. And I said, an ambulance? And he said, yes, sir. I said, you're not sending me to the hospital, and two, you're sure not sending me in an ambulance. Yes, we are. He says, look at here. Bomb shot. Drowned, missing in action. Look at this. So I said, well, I don't want to go. And all of a sudden he turned to me and he says, sir, I am engaged in trying to save your life, whether it is worth anything to you or not. Call the ambulance. Took me to the hospital, put me in bed for 2 weeks. I was perfectly okay. Nothing wrong with me. But it gave me a whole year to sit around and study, because by taking off one collar marker and by having wounded Marines address me at the librarian's desk as doctor, carefully, you know, I'd be standing at the desk nonchalantly, you know, discussing it with this pretty librarian and so forth, and this Marine already bribed, you see, with a pack of cigarettes. He'd come up and he'd say, oh, hiya, Doc. How you doing today? And the girl would look at me and call her tabs and so on. He says, it's okay if I go into the medical library. That's okay. That was reserved for hospital medical staff. See? I go in the medical library and around through the clinics and fix things up. And I got a long time to study things. And I studied things out pretty good. When the war finished up, why, I was still in very second-hand condition, but functioning. As a matter of fact, it was quite romantic. I mean, I should be ashamed of myself. Nobody permitted you to be out of uniform. You couldn't get out of your ruddy uniform, you know. Campaign medals all over, you know, and stripes, and walking with a cane, you know. It's pretty terrific, you know. All I had to do was walk into a major studio in Hollywood, you know, and the producers would say, "Hubbard, you want a job?" I don't know what the jobs were supposed to be, actually. They were supposed to be for writing. But it was usually technical assistance of one character or another. I went on like that for a long time, was surveyed for final retirement from the Navy. Not just dismissal, but to be retired. They're going to give me $225 a month for the rest of my life. Wouldn't that nice? But unfortunately, I used to upset their experiments at that hospital because I'd get their patients and do psychotherapy on them, you see. And then the patients would go back in and be tested, and they think their remedies were working. And they were. But I knew their remedies weren't working, so I could go in and look at their record books and find out by actual test whether mine were. I mean, there was an doctor there with the improbable name of Yankee Wits, who turned on me with furious anger one day, and he said, "I've seen you now. Now I know what you're doing. You were down there sitting under that tree and so on, and you were talking to that young Marine, and all of these good results I've been getting from formulas, because you've been talking to him, I know." I said, "Well, you mad because he's well?" And he says, "No." He says, "I'm upset. I'm upset because all of these research reports are wrong." I said, "No, they're right." I said, "Someday they're going to do some people a lot of good." And he said, "Well, maybe so. I hope so." So they've done some people a lot of good. So the whole expenditure in that hospital wasn't wasted. But as the years went on, of course, I had secretaries and so forth who I would train to audit, and people around, and guys, and audit other people and do research, one character or another. And I remember one old lady, she was a most fabulous-looking kobold you ever wanted to see. But I made a whiz of an auditor out of her. Boy, she'd really get in there and pitch. The only thing she'd do occasionally is she'd get so excited when she had somebody on the back track. She'd just keep saying, "Stay there now until we get it all. Stay there now." Well, with this early auditing, and very indifferent it was, and very punchy and hit or miss, and so on, in 1948, I was taken to the Naval Hospital at Bethesda, Maryland, and they examined me for 10 days to send me up before the retiring board. And the retiring board at Bethesda was in Washington, was the final board that I had to go through in order to get my $225 a month for the rest of my life. Of course, this isn't an important sum of money, but it just gives you some kind of an idea of it. And I went through there for 10 days, and they stuck tubes into my nostrils and down into my stomach, and they kept pounding me with little hammers and x-raying me and so on. I got so photostatic and electronic that I was up to a point where they were going to use me as a spare atom bomb. They were really taking the photographs. Well, I got down to my room there one day, and I found about three doctors sitting there. And they said, "What is your name, really?" "Well, that may be, but come with us down to the fingerprint division, because we're going to fingerprint you." So they fingerprinted me and all. Took my height, width, name, rank, serial number, why my grandfather had to marry the girl. They got me into a fine state, they did. And 10 days after that, they raised the dickens with me, because the stuff came back saying, this is L. Ron Hubbard, this is the right man, and his service record, therefore, must be wrong. They couldn't get the two things to compare. They threw me down the retiring board. Nine of the nastiest old men you ever wanted to see sat around the board and sneered. I just came in, you know, and they looked through the service record, they looked through the final reports, threw it across the desk to me and said, you're not being retired. I heard from my naval district. My naval district said, well, you see, this was very upset. There was nothing wrong with me. I didn't have a broken spine, and I could see, and I wasn't lame for life, and so forth. And auditing had done all this by 1948, you see. This rubbed it out. And it's a matter of very strange fact here. It's still a matter of record. Who was this busted-up character? He must have disappeared someplace in the gutters of the world. And I got the nastiest letter from my naval district you ever wanted to hear. As an officer, you are returned to full duty in the reserve and are certified for all duties, especially combat of your rank and grade, and will report instantly and at once. Boy, were they mad. Because they figured they had a goal break, you see, a real goof-off. There was nothing wrong with this guy. I would probably have been in the Korean War if I hadn't resigned. Well, that's what auditing did for me. It cost me $225 a month. But believe me, I would pay $500 a month if it meant being able to walk, talk, and see it in. Now, I have just a moment or two to give you a little more data here. I didn't mean to get off on this long wing-ding, not particularly important. But it has done something for me, and I do get audited even today, when I can get an auditor who isn't engaged. Most of them are engaged all the time. But when I send out the word, usually somebody whistles up in a hurry. And after all, this 20,000-mile jaunt, believe me, I could use some. We have a new chart that I would like to give you a very short, cursory statement on before we're finished up here on this one lecture. This chart hasn't any name, but it's the chart you can use to interest people in Dianetics and Scientology. This chart, by the way, is a more complicated chart than it has been released. I'm just going to write it for you here rapidly, and then you will be able to understand a little bit better about your compatriots. Here's interest and failed interest. Here's communication and failed communication. Here is control and failed control. And here is help and failed help. These four things give you the basic clue to human beings. When interest goes out, communication is still there. When communication and interest are out, control is still there. When interest, communication, and control are out, help is still there. And when help is gone, you have nothing. But there's more chart. When help is gone, you get overts. People do things to people that they cannot help. Every criminal has failed to help. And then, of course, you have failed overts. And below that, when overts fail, you get withholds. And then you get failed withholds. I know some of you have had to give up your name, rank, serial number, and why you had to marry the girl to your auditor. Know what a failed withhold is. And below this, we get leaving. Overts, withholds, leaving. When you do overts, you get withholds, and when overts and withholds fail, you get the desire to leave, to blow. But when you can't blow, you get failed leaving. Want to leave, but can't leave. I'm sorry if that sounds like I have just characterized the whole human race. But there's where they sit. And there's more chart below that. When they can no longer leave, they protect. And when they can't protect, you've got, of course, failed protection. And when you have failed protection, you have abandon. Now we're getting leaving over there. That's leaving. And below leaving, we have failed abandonment. When we get abandonment, the person wants to abandon everything and so forth. Even though they can't leave, they can abandon. You get the idea? They can say, well, I don't care. I quit. You know. You then get your inverted scale, which is inverted help. Which means simply this. Help equals betrayal. Try to help somebody, he knows what you're doing, you're betraying him. And of course, below inverted help, we have inverted control. Now that's very interesting, inverted control. That means all control is bad control. Any effort to control anything, that means a bank that goes flitter, 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 flitter. That won't stay in any kind of a position at all. Now we have inverted communication. And this means all calm equals lies. Communicate is to lie. And then we have the lowest rung of all, which is inverted interest. And there, we're at the bottom of the barrel. Freud was interested in this level only. Perversions, strange tokens, strange associations, and so forth. He was interested in this level. You take this chart, which goes from the bottom, inverted interest, inverted communication, goes up to inverted control, goes up to inverted help. You see why somebody who is a pervert or something like that is terribly hard to process. Look what he goes through. As you're processing him, look what he goes through. And he gets up to a point where he can abandon everything. And then he gets into a failure to protect. Now he knows he can fail to protect things. Now he can protect things. He's getting right on back up the line. He's sad because he can't leave. Now he's got to leave. Now he gets up here. He must have withholds that he knows are withholds. Now he's up here to overts that he knows are overts. And then he can help somebody. Now there, as far as I'm concerned, is the entire gamut of cases. There's the whole ready lot. Anybody who is below this point is in need of help very seriously. Because from here on down, look. Look, you can go way down below this. Look. Long time I've been looking for the bottom of the barrel. There it is. So I can announce to you we have found the bottom of the barrel. And some cases, given enough diving gear and given enough oxygen, can get up to the top. Well, I didn't mean to introduce too much technology on you newcomers, but kind of that's the way it is. And if you didn't find this of any help, study the lower parts of the chart. The whole gamut of the human race is a pretty wide one. You wonder, how can they live? I don't know. But just as I believed completely and utterly in 1946 that I'd never see the light of day again, just as I believed that I'd never walk again, why, so most people believe today. But after I'd been on it for a little while, I decided that was an awful state of mind to be in, and I decided I might as well try to do something about it. I did. I won. You can too. Thank you.